Chapter 6. An Essay on the Bourgeois. Why does everyone here want to shrink back and shrivel and make out he is only small fry and remain as inconspicuous as possible? I don't exist. I don't exist at all. I'm hiding. Walk past. Please don't take any notice of me. Pretend you don't see me. Pass along. Pass along. But whom are you talking about? Who shrinks back? The bourgeois, of course. Come now, he is king, he is everything. Le tiers état, c'est tout. And you say he shrinks back. Oh yes, he does. Why otherwise should he have hidden himself behind the Emperor Napoleon? Why has he forgotten the lofty language he used to love so much in the Chamber of Deputies? Why does he not want to remember anything and runs away from any reminders of the past? Why do his thoughts, his eyes, his speech betray so much worry whenever others dare express a wish for something in his presence? Why, whenever he foolishly forgets himself and expresses a wish for something, does he suddenly give a start and begin to deny his own words? Good heavens, what's the matter with me, really? And for a long time after that he tries scrupulously to make amends for his behaviour by conscientiousness and obedience. Why does he look and almost say, "Well now, I'll do a bit of trade in my shop today, and God willing I'll do a bit of trade tomorrow too, and perhaps even the day after if the Lord lets me in his great mercy. And then, oh, if only I could save just a teeny bit, and après moi le déluge." Why does he stick his paw out of the way somewhere and assure people that there aren't any? Why does he make do with official literature? Why does he so much want to convince himself that his newspapers are not open to bribery? Why does he agree to give so much money for the maintenance of police spies? Why does he not dare breathe a word about the Mexican expedition? Why on the stage are husbands made out to be so very noble-minded and rich, while lovers are all so tattered, jobless and friendless, clerks or artists, so much trash? Why does he imagine that all wives, without exception, are faithful to the last extreme, that the home prospers, that the pot of fur is cooking on the most virtuous of hearths, and that no horns disfigure his forehead? About the horns. This has been decided once and for all, agreed without further ado and taken for granted, and though cabs with drawn blinds constantly ply up and down the boulevards, though time and place can always be found for requirements of an interesting nature, and though wives very often dress more expensively than could be warranted by the husband's pocket, this has been agreed and ratified. And what more do you want? And why has it been agreed and ratified? The answer is quite obvious. Otherwise, people might perhaps think that an ideal state of things has not been reached yet, that Paris is not yet heaven on earth, that something could perhaps still be wished for, that therefore the bourgeois himself is not quite satisfied with the state of things which he supports and which he tries to force on everyone, that the cloth of society has rents which must be mended. This is precisely why the bourgeois smears holes in his shoes with ink, lest, God forbid, people should notice anything. The wives, in the meantime, suck sweets, wear gloves of a kind to send Russian ladies in far-off St. Petersburg into envious hysterics, show their little feet and lift their skirts on boulevards with all the grace in the world. What more is needed for perfect bliss? It follows that, circumstances being what they are, novels can no longer bear titles such as, for example, Wife, Husband, and Lover, because there are no and cannot be any lovers. And even if in Paris they were as numerous as the sands of the sea, and maybe they are even more numerous there are none there all the same. And there cannot be any because it is thus agreed and ratified, and because virtue shines everywhere. That is the way it should be. Virtue must shine everywhere. The sight of the great courtyard of the Palais Royal in the evening and up to 11 o'clock at night is surely enough to make anyone shed a sentimental tear. Innumerable husbands stroll about arm in arm with their innumerable spouses. Their sweet and well-behaved children gambol round them, A little fountain tinkles, and its monotonous splash reminds you of something still and quiet, everlasting, permanent, Heidelbergian. And it isn't as if there was only one little fountain in Paris tinkling in this way. There are many little fountains, and everywhere it is the same, and one's heart rejoices at the sight of it all. Paris has an unquenchable thirst for virtue. Nowadays your Frenchman is a serious and reliable man, often tender-hearted, so I cannot understand why he is so afraid of something even now, and is afraid of it in spite of all the gloire militaire which flourishes in France, and which Jacques Bonhomme pays so much for. The Parisian dearly loves to trade, but even as he trades and fleeces you in his shop, he fleeces you not for the sake of profit, as in the old days, but in the name of virtue, out of some sacred necessity. To amass a fortune and possess as many things as possible, this has become the Parisian's main moral code, to be equated with religious observance. The same thing happened in the old days too, but now it has assumed, so to speak, a sort of sacramental aspect. In the old days, some value was attached to other things besides money, so that a man with no money but possessing other qualities could expect some kind of esteem. But now, nothing doing. Now you must make money and acquire as many things as possible, and you will then be able to expect at least some sort of esteem. Otherwise you cannot expect to have any self-esteem, let alone the esteem of other people. The Parisian has a very low opinion of himself if he feels his pockets are empty, and he holds this opinion consciously and with great conviction. You are allowed to do amazing things if only you have money. Poor Socrates is nothing but a stupid and obnoxious phrase-monger, and is esteemed, if anywhere, only in the theatre, because the bourgeois still likes to show esteem for virtue in the theatre. A strange man, this bourgeois, proclaims openly that the acquisition of money is the supreme virtue and human duty, and yet dearly loves to play at supremely noble sentiments. All Frenchmen have an extraordinarily noble appearance. The meanest little Frenchman, who would sell you his own father for sixpence and add something into the bargain without so much as being asked for it, has at the same time, indeed at the very moment of selling you his own father, such an impressive bearing that you feel perplexed. Go into a shop to buy something, and its least important salesman will crush you, simply crush you, with his astounding nobility. These are the very salesmen who serve as models of the most exquisite refinement for our Mikhailovsky Theatre. You are overwhelmed. You feel you have offended the salesman in some way. You have come, let us say, with the intention of spending 10 francs, and yet you are received as if you were the Duke of Devonshire. For some reason you at once feel terribly ashamed, and you want to assure people quickly that you are not at all the Duke of Devonshire, but somebody quite ordinary, just a simple traveller, and have come in to make a mere 10 francs worth of purchase. But the young man, who has a most fortunate appearance and an ineffably noble expression, and at the sight of whom you are ready to acknowledge yourself a rascal, because he has such a noble expression, begins to spread in front of you goods worth tens of thousands of francs. In a minute he has strewn the whole counter with his wares, and when you realize how much the poor man will have to fold and wrap up again after you are gone, and that he, this Grandison, this Alcibiades, this Montmorency, will have to do it, after whom? After you, who, with your unenviable appearance, your vices and defects, your abominable 10 francs, have dared come and worry so lordly a creature. When you realize all this, you immediately, on the spot and before you have time to leave the counter, begin willy-nilly to despise yourself to the highest possible degree. You repent and curse your fate for having only 100 francs in your pocket. You throw them down on the counter with an imploring look, asking forgiveness. But the article you have bought for your miserable 100 francs is magnanimously wrapped up for you. You are forgiven all the worry and all the trouble which you have caused in the shop, and you hasten to come out and vanish. When you get home, you are terribly surprised that you wanted to spend only 10 francs and have spent 100. How often, when walking down the boulevards or the Rue Vivienne, where so many huge haberdashery stores are situated, I used to say to myself, "If only Russian ladies were let loose here," and... But what follows is best known to the factors and bailiffs of estates in Arlov, Tambov, and other provinces. In general, Russians in shops long to show that they have a boundless amount of money. On the other hand, what is one to think of such shameless conduct as that of English women, for example, who not only are left completely unperturbed by the fact that some Adonis or William Tell has piled up goods on his counter and turned the whole shop upside down, but even, oh horrors, begin to argue for the sake of some 10 francs? But William Tell is no simpleton either. He will take his revenge all right, and for a scarf worth 1,500 francs will rook Milady 12,000, and do it in a way which will leave her completely satisfied. But in spite of this, the bourgeois is passionately fond of unutterable high-mindedness. On the stage he must have nothing but people completely disinterested in money. Gustave must shine by the light of high-mindedness alone, and the bourgeois sheds tears of tender emotion. Without unutterable high-mindedness, he will not even sleep quietly. And as to taking 12,000 francs instead of 1,500, this was his duty. He took it because he was virtuous. To steal is wicked and mean. That's what the galleys are for. The bourgeois is ready to forgive a great deal, but he will not forgive stealing, even if you and your children should be dying of starvation. But should you steal for virtue's sake, then, oh, then, everything is forgiven unto you. It means you want to faire fortune and amass many possessions, i.e. perform a natural and human duty. In other words, the legal code very clearly defines stealing for low motives, i.e. for the sake of a piece of bread, and stealing in the name of highest virtue. The latter is completely assured, encouraged, and is organized on an extraordinarily sound footing. Why then, I am back at my old theme again, why then does the bourgeois look nervous and ill at ease? What causes him all this worry? The speechifiers, the phrasemongers. But he can send them all to hell with one kick of his foot. Arguments of pure reason? But reason has proved bankrupt in face of reality, and besides, the rational people themselves, the philosophers and metaphysicians, are now beginning to teach that there are no arguments of pure reason, that pure reason does not even exist in this world, that abstract logic is not applicable to humanity, that there is such a thing as John's, Peter's, or Gustav's reason, but there has never been any pure reason, that it is a baseless fiction of the 18th century. Whom should he fear, then? Workers? But workers are all of them capitalists, too, in their heart of hearts. Their one ideal is to become capitalists, and amass as many things as possible. Such is their nature. People don't get their nature for nothing. All this requires centuries of growth and upbringing. National characteristics cannot easily be altered. It is not easy to get away from centuries-old habits which have become part of our flesh and blood. Peasants? But French peasants are capitalists par excellence, the obtuse kind of capitalists, i.e. the very best and the most ideally perfect type of capitalist that can possibly be imagined. Communists, or perhaps socialists? But these fellows have considerably compromised themselves in their day, and in his heart of hearts the bourgeois has a profound contempt for them. And yet, for all his contempt, he is afraid of them. In fact, these are the people he fears. But why should he fear them, really? For did not the Abbé Sieyès, in his famous pamphlet, predict that the bourgeois would be everything? What is the tiers état? Nothing. What must it be? Everything. Well now, things have turned out as he foretold them. Of all the words spoken at the time, they were the only ones to have come true, the only ones to have remained. But the bourgeois still refuses to believe somehow, despite the fact that all that has been said since Sieyès's words has collapsed and burst like a soap bubble. Indeed, soon after him was proclaimed the principle of liberté, égalité, fraternité. Excellent. What is liberté? Freedom. What freedom? Equal freedom for all to do anything one wants within the limits of the law. When can a man do anything he wants? When he has a million. Does freedom give everyone a million? No. What is a man without a million? A man without a million is not a man who does anything he wants, but a man with whom anything is done that anyone wants. And what follows? What follows is that besides freedom, there is also equality. In fact, equality before the law. There is only one thing to be said about this equality before the law, that the way in which it is now applied enables, indeed forces, every Frenchman to consider it as a personal insult. What then remains of the formula? Fraternity, brotherhood. Now, this is a most curious concept, and, it must be admitted, constitutes the principal stumbling block in the West. The Western man speaks of brotherhood as of the great moving force of humanity, and does not realize that brotherhood cannot come about if it does not exist in fact. What is to be done? Brotherhood must be created at all costs. But it turns out that brotherhood cannot be created, because it creates itself, is given, exists in nature. It was, however, found to be absent in French and in Western nature generally. What was found to exist instead was the principle of individuality, the principle of isolation, of intensified self-preservation, of self-seeking, of self-determination within one's own personality or self. Of contrast between this self, the whole of nature, and the rest of humanity, and this contrast was considered as an independent and separate principle completely equal and equivalent in value to all that existed apart from itself. Now, such a contrast could not produce brotherhood. Why? Because within brotherhood, true brotherhood, it is not the individual personality, not the self, that should lay claim to its right of equality in value and importance with all the rest, but all this rest should itself approach the individual, the separate self laying this claim, and should itself, without being asked, recognize the individual as its equal in value and rights, i.e., the equal of all else that exists in the world. Nay more, the individual who rebels and makes claims should much rather sacrifice both his personality and the whole of himself to society, and not only not claim his rights, but on the contrary, hand them over unconditionally to society. But the Western individual is not used to this kind of procedure. He demands by force. He demands rights. He wants to go shares. And naturally, no brotherhood results. There is, of course, the possibility of regeneration. But such a regeneration takes thousands of years, for ideas of this kind must, first of all, become completely ingrained and assimilated in order to become reality. Well then, you will reply, one must lose one's individuality in order to be happy. Is salvation to be found in the absence of individuality? My reply is no, on the contrary. Not only should one not lose one's individuality, but one should, in fact, become an individual to a degree far higher than has occurred in the West. You must understand me. a voluntary, absolutely conscious and completely unforced sacrifice of oneself for the sake of all is, I consider, a sign of the highest development of individual personality, its highest power, highest self-possession, and highest freedom of the individual will. Voluntarily to lay down one's life for all, be crucified or burned at the stake for the sake of all, is possible only at the point of the highest development of individual personality. A strongly developed individual personality, completely sure of its right to be a personality and deprived of all fear for itself, can, in fact, do nothing else out of its personality, can put it, that is, to no other use than to give away the whole of it to all, in order that others too may become personalities just as independent and happy. This is a law of nature. Man normally tends towards it. Here, however, there is a hair, one very, very thin hair, but if it gets into the machine, all will immediately crack and collapse. It is the following. There must not be in this case the slightest motive of personal gain. For example, I offer myself as a total sacrifice for all, and this is as it should be. I should sacrifice myself wholly and irrevocably, without consideration of gain, not thinking in the least that here I am, sacrificing my entire self to society, and in exchange society will offer the whole of itself to me. One must, in fact, make one's sacrifice with the intention of giving away everything, and even wish that nothing be given to you in exchange, and that no one should spend anything on you. Now, how is this to be done? Surely this is rather like trying not to think of a polar bear. Try and set yourself the problem of not thinking about a polar bear, and you will see that the damned animal will be constantly in your thoughts. What can we do, then? We can do nothing. It must be done of itself. The solution must exist in nature, must form an unconscious part of the nature of the whole race. What is needed, in short, is the principle of brotherhood and love. We must love. Man must instinctively and of his own accord be drawn towards brotherhood, fellowship, and concord, and he must be drawn towards them despite immemorial sufferings of his nation, despite the barbarous brutality and ignorance which have become rooted in the nation, despite age-old slavery and foreign invasions. The need for brotherly fellowship must, in fact, have its being in the nature of man. He must be born with it, or else have acquired the habit of it from time immemorial. What would this brotherhood consist in, if expressed in rational and conscious language? In each particular individual, without constraint or gain to himself, saying to society, "We are strong only when we are all together. Therefore take the whole of me if you need me. Do not think of me when you pass your laws. Do not worry in the slightest. I am handing all my rights over to you, and please dispose of me as you wish. It is the height of happiness for me to sacrifice everything to you, and in such a way that you do not suffer any loss in consequence. I shall fade away and merge with the completely uniform mass. Only let your brotherhood remain and flourish." And the brotherhood, on the other hand, must say, "You are giving us too much. We have no right to refuse what you have to give, since you yourself say that therein consists the whole of your happiness. But what can we do, since we too care unceasingly for your happiness? You too, then, must take everything from us. We shall always do all we can that you might have as much personal freedom and as much independence as possible. You need no longer fear any enemies, either men or nature. You have the support of all of us. We all guarantee your safety and have your interests at heart night and day, because we are brothers. We are all brothers of yours, and there are many of us, and we are strong. Therefore do not worry, be of good cheer, fear nothing, and put your trust in us." After this, there will be no necessity for sharing things out. They will all share themselves out automatically. Love one another, and all these things will be added unto you. What a utopia this is, really! It is all based on sentiment and on nature and not on reason. Surely this is humiliating for reason. What do you think? Is this utopia or not? But then what can a socialist do if the principles of brotherhood is absent in Western man, who recognizes, on the contrary, the individual and personal principle which always insists on isolation and on demanding rights, sword in hand? Because there is no brotherhood, he wants to create it, to build it up. To make jugged hair, you must begin by having a hair. But there is no hair. There is, in other words, no nature capable of brotherhood, no nature with a belief in brotherhood or drawn towards brotherhood. In desperation, the socialist begins to make and define the future brotherhood, weighs and measures it, throws out the bait of personal advantage, explains, teaches, and tells people how much advantage each person will obtain out of this brotherhood, how much each will gain. He determines the utility and cost of each individual, and works out in advance the balance of this world's blessings. How much each individual deserves them, and how much each individual must voluntarily contribute to the community in exchange for them at the cost of his own personality. But how can there possibly be any brotherhood if it is preceded by a distribution of shares, and by determining how much each person has earned and what each must do? However, a formula was proclaimed which said, "Each for all and all for each." Nothing better than this could naturally be thought up, particularly as the whole formula was lifted in its entirety from a well-known book. But then the brethren began to apply this formula in practice, and about 6 months later brought an action against the founder of the brotherhood, Cabé. The Fourierists have, it is said, spent the last 900,000 francs of their capital, but are still trying to organize a brotherhood. The results are nil. Of course, it is very tempting to live according to purely rational, if not brotherly, principles, that is, to live well when you are guaranteed by everyone and nothing is demanded of you except your consent and your work. But here again there is a curious paradox. A man is offered full security, promised food and drink, and found work, and as against this he is merely required to give up a tiny grain of his personal freedom for the sake of the common good, just a tiny, tiny grain. But man does not want to live on these conditions. He finds even the tiny grain too irksome. He thinks that he is being put in jail, poor fool, and that he would be better off by himself, because then he would have full freedom. And when he is free, he is knocked about and refused work. He starves to death and has no real freedom. But all the same, the strange fellow still prefers his own freedom. Naturally enough, the socialist is simply forced to give him up and tell him that he is a fool, that he is not ready yet, not ripe enough to understand what is good for him, that a dumb little ant, a miserable ant, is more intelligent than he is, because everything is so lovely in an anthill, so well ordered, no one goes hungry and all are happy. Everyone knows what he has to do. In fact, man has a long way to go before he can hope to reach the standards of an anthill. In other words, though socialism is possible, it is possible anywhere but in France. And so, in final despair, the socialist proclaims at last, "Liberté, égalité, fraternité, ou la mort." Then there is no more to be said, and the bourgeois is completely triumphant. And if the bourgeois is triumphant, it means that Sieyès's formula has come true literally and to the last detail. And so the bourgeois is everything. Why then is he shy and retiring? What does he fear? Everyone has collapsed. None has proved capable of standing up to him. In the old days, At the time of Louis-Philippe, for example, the bourgeois were not as shy and timid, and yet he reigned then too. Indeed, he still fought then, sensed that he had an enemy, and finally defeated him on the June barricades with the aid of rifle and bayonet. But when the battle was over, the bourgeois suddenly realized that he was alone in the world, that there was nothing better than himself, that he was the ideal, and that instead of trying as hitherto to convince the whole of humanity that he was the ideal, all that was left for him to do was simply to pose with quiet dignity in the eyes of humanity as the last word in human beauty and perfection. A ticklish situation, say what you will. Salvation came from Napoleon III. For the bourgeois, he was the gift of the gods, the only way out of the difficulty, the only possibility available at the time. From that moment on, the bourgeois begins to prosper, pays a frightful lot for his prosperity, and fears everything just because he has attained everything. When one attains everything, it is hard to lose everything. Whence follows, my friends, that he who fears most prospers most. Don't laugh, please. For what is a bourgeois these days?